Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 25th, 2003. Today's session is entitled With Christ and Stanley Spencer in the Wilderness. Session 4 of Roadmaps and Detours, Stories and Images from 5 Years in the Holy Land, presented by Susan and Michael Thomas. The number is THM-2003-09. Let's listen in.
As I said, it looks like this is going to be a conversation among friends. Welcome. Come on in. I'm Michael Thomas, and I have just returned from Jerusalem, the Lutheran Church of the Redeemer, serving there for 5 years. And now I'm going to move to a part of the United States that also has a touch of wilderness to it, and the Appalachian Trail, and the mountains of Vermont, and the Connecticut River, and the Appalachian Trail. I'm glad that we're few in number, because what I'm talking about is really the results of research on early Christian theology, especially looking at the argument about icons and trying to understand what was really an issue in early Christian art and in the development of the icon and in the rejection of the icon, and then subsequently to that, the acceptance of the icon, where the image won out, in a sense, over much stronger scriptural interpretation against prohibiting icons. It's really, it's very clear. But I'm glad that they did, because what I want to do today is invite all of us to see beyond the word, see beyond the controversy. And I want to try to have a conversation, so I really invite you to just speak up if something isn't clear, or if you have an insight or a question that you'd like to share. And I think the first thing I want to ask is, what's your image of wilderness? I have here a map of the Holden area quadrant, and people here explore this area all the time. Some people walked in using this map. And so in a sense, this is an image, a two-dimensional image of wilderness. Though I'm reminded, I just bought a book in the Holden bookstore by Gail Ramshaw on the lectionary. And I was keen to find out if she had a specific section where she looks at images in the, that appear in the three-year lectionary. And then she groups them sort of according to families. And so I was really hoping that she would have a whole section that I could use today on wilderness or desert. And she doesn't. She has a very brief section on mountain. And that's related, in fact, to desert and wilderness, which, as I'm sure all of you know, is the same in Greek. Though she does make this throwaway comment that I appreciated, she said that wilderness, I take that to mean the sense that she understands it in terms of Christian tradition, wilderness is not the place you take your children for a vacation. It's not Disneyland. It's not the public park. It's a place of encounter, encountering demons, sometimes being sent into the wilderness by demons. There's a, you know, the story of the demons that are, that send the ill spirits into the desert. And it's a place where we respond to our own demons. So anyway, I'd just like to throw open, what's your image of wilderness?
I'd like to share a story that we moved from Ohio, which is really like a rainforest in a sense, to a church in Pueblo, Colorado, which is high desert. And was there really separated from my family for about 10 months until the house sold and our son came out. He was a sophomore in high school who was not too excited about moving anyway. And he had been there for about a month, and it was my birthday, and he made a homemade birthday card. And he's not much of an artist, but I could see a sun and a desert scene on the front of it. On the inside, he wrote, "The sun is hot, the land is desolate. You moved my life out here and made a mess of it. Happy birthday, Dad. Love, Clay."
you've driven him into the wilderness. Yeah.
So in a sense, I said, hey, that's pretty good, son. You rhyme desolate with mess of it. But for him, in a sense, you know, that was wilderness. Yeah. You know, in a sense, being cut off from not only the sun mm-hmm. and the desert, but I think also cutting off from friends, mm-hmm. what is known mm-hmm. to the unknown, all of that is wilderness.
I have a really strong positive response to wilderness, which I think is kind of a problem for many of my people in reading scripture, because the way you've described it is the scriptural understanding of wilderness, I think, for the most part. And our people, you know, think of wilderness as the boundary waters of Minnesota mm-hmm. and Canada, and they love to go there. It's where you go intentionally with your children
for recreation
on vacation. For recreation. And just like the people come hiking out here, they do it willingly as an escape from the wilderness of the city. In some cases. So, you know, we've got that romantic thing going in our country that is much stronger, I think, than any kind of negative images.
Yeah, cutting us to the woods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And but Andrew and Patty, you know, you certainly would, well, I don't know, I should let you speak, but.
Well, let's just try to say guess what they would say.
He could probably come close.
There's an element of where I mirror that feeling and thought. I think when I went and did some training at the tracker, and Tom Brown said, you know, Starkenwolf said, if you go into the woods with a knife, it's not survival, it's camping. You know, so some shifts consciously were happening where I realized wilderness, one way to use the word wilderness for me is not the boundary water, go with a group, but is what I realized when I told people that I was going to go into the boundary waters by myself. Mm-hmm. And that brings a whole different reaction than just going to the boundary waters. Because most people would not do that for any number of reasons. So wilderness to me also can be a sense of entering alone into a situation where there are not clear paths. Mm-hmm. However you want to take that. So, I mean, it may be going to Colorado. You know, sense of being alone where there are no longer clear paths that you're used to. I mean, that can be a wilderness experience or mm-hmm. literally the woods or wherever. But mm-hmm. for me, it's a sense of aloneness. Where it's out of your comfort zone.
Yeah. We had a friend who recently left press, the most prestigious of the international English-speaking churches, and he said that he had been at this church for 9 years in probably the most interesting city in Europe, and he said, you know, I feel like I've been in the wilderness for 9 years there. And he was talking about human relations and friendship. And so in the midst of this most fascinating city, he felt in the wilderness. And when I was talking with Susan about what I wanted to do today, talking about this English artist Stanley Spencer, and talking about the wilderness of the Holy Land, our wilderness, she asked if I was going to connect it to what's happening in the Holy Land today in terms of the conflict. And I said, no, I had any intention of doing so. That it was sort of an aesthetic and spiritual encounter. I wasn't going to be talking about politics. In fact, it was going to be a kind of release from political anxieties and fears. But then, as I was putting together the group of pictures that you're about to see, I saw that I couldn't leave out what were some of the wilderness experiences that we had in Israel and Palestine. So on one hand, we had fantastic experiences in the Sinai. I think for me, that's my image of wilderness, of barrenness, of encounter, of no paths, of cutting loose, of sharp rocks, of rocks that the Bedouins talk about. The noise that they make is like the noise that demons make. It's kind of a metallic noise when you're going on the scree, climbing up something. And early Christian pilgrims to Mount Sinai talked about that no one could live on the top of Mount Sinai overnight because of the fierce storms and lightning, though they're really, I think it's remarkably quiet. The wind certainly picks up, and you can imagine that there can be very fierce storms. In the winter, it snows on the top. But just this image of the mountain and all through Christian tradition. So what I want to do is sort of begin as far, almost as far away as you can imagine from Mount Sinai, from the barrenness of the Sinai, to an English village about 30 miles west of London called Cookham, which was the home of Stanley Spencer. Spencer lived from 1891 to 1959. And I think that it's arguable that he's probably the finest English painter, certainly the first half of the 20th century. And one of the things that's interesting is that he has a kind of successor in a man named Lucian Freud, who's Sigmund Freud's grandson. And Spencer and Sigmund Freud, at a critical time, lived very close together in a part of London called Swiss Cottage. So I think it's interesting that the person that is maybe the finest painter in England now, Lucian Freud, has this kind of indirect connection to Spencer. It follows very much in Spencer's representational tradition. So Spencer loved this village. In fact, the nickname when he went to school, art school, was Cookham. Everyone called him Cookham. He was so attached to this village and to the church there, though he wasn't really, he really spent much more time at the Methodist church, certainly much more modest in town. And what we're going to do is go through a series of slides, then we're going to come back, because I think one of the things that wilderness ought to do is help us or challenge us to see deeper. And so we're going to come back, and we're going to have a kind of meditation where we're going to listen to a piece of music at the end, and you'll see these slides again. But this is in this very, you know, if you talk about, how did you describe Ohio?
Rainforest.
A rainforest. Well, I mean, it's so moist, and you just sort of breathe in the moisture in England. This is in January. I think the tree is in flower. Yeah, that's right. It was the beginning of January. We wanted to see where, since Cookham had been so important to Spencer, we wanted to see where he lived. And it's because place, I mean, it has, in a way, closely connects with who we are, and who we are is closely connected to place. Spencer says somewhere that the fulfillment of place is the person, and the person is the fulfillment of place. Now, perhaps in the wilderness, that's not always the case. But one of the things that has struck us in the Holy Land is what's called the fifth gospel, which is the notion of the land, the geography of place, of sacred geography. And that if you know that, then you can know the stories in a deeper way. And I think that is really true. I think that even though, you know, sometimes pilgrims go to the Holy Land and they say, oh, you know, I felt really close to Jesus. And I know that they mean it, and sometimes I've had that experience. Often you feel terribly far away. We were talking about the Church of the Resurrection in Jerusalem today, and Maury's first encounter with that church. And at times, though, when I was listening to the gospel, I don't think it was last night, but earlier in the week, I can see Palestinians easily. And I can hear their accents and their stories. get in the churchyard. And this is the home that Spencer grew up in. He grew up on the right side of a home that was built by his grandfather, Brick Mason. And he was essentially self-educated, and he was truly a voracious reader. He read everything starting at about the time he was 18, and he read for the rest of his life. He knew scripture very, very well. And this is a painting from 1911 by Spencer. And what he does is he takes a landscape. I don't know, I mean, let me also say that I took these pictures the other day I photographed them out of a paperback. So the quality is not as good, the color is not as good. Now the pictures that I'm going to show you of Christ in the wilderness, those I have copyright permission for. These I just took.
We won't tell.
Okay, this is called John Donne Entering Heaven. So once you sort of give it that name, I think you begin to look at the landscape in a very different way. Once the landscape is peopled, and we're going to look at another example of a landscape peopled by people wandering on a Shabbat. This is probably one of his most remarkable series, and I'm very sorry that I don't have a good reproduction. He was asked to do a war memorial for a well-to-do family who had lost a brother in the Great War, World War I. And so he was given authorization to design the building and a whole series of frescoes. And what's really remarkable, the floor is essentially a brown wooden floor. The reflection from the photograph is it's bluish cast. So this is a pulpit or lectern or door. This is the altar right here. And what's really remarkable, we'll come in a little closer. Because I can't do it with this kind of slideshow. What's really remarkable is what you have a field here of soldiers and horses and carts, and you know, as you can see, hundreds of crosses. And Christ is in here, and it's probably pointless to try to point it out, but he's a very small figure. In other words, he's not the figure that the eye goes to immediately. And the cross, Spencer is connecting where people die and where they are resurrected. In other words, place and person again together. And the cross is, I think, is really magisterial. It reflects something of 14th century Italian painting in terms of the way that the perspective works here. So the crosses come out, so it almost looks like the crosses are on the altar here. So the altar is, of course, three-dimensional, and everything behind that is two-dimensional. And it goes all the way around. It's a large war memorial. And I think it would have been well worth just doing the paper on this memorial. This is a painting. He was married. He met a fellow artist named Hilda. And I'm blanking on her last name right now. Who was really his spiritual soulmate. There's no doubt about that. And yet he did a very foolish thing. He fell in love largely for reasons of desire and reasons to sort of marry a little higher. And somehow in a thinking that was skewed, he thought that somehow he could keep Hilda, sort of like perhaps Kierkegaard, thinking that somehow with his cutting off of the engagement, nonetheless, God would find a way for him to keep the engagement. And so they divorced, and he married a woman that had no use for him, no interest in him other than his financial assistance and artistic help, and promptly got him to sign over his house in Cookham and then evicted him from the house. And that's where the Christ in the Wilderness pictures begin. So Hilda was the person that he begged to have her come back to him. And they wrote long, long letters. And even after she died of cancer, he wrote letters to her. And so here you have, this is called the letters, and the exchange of letters. So she's putting a letter, or holding a letter out of a pocket, putting a letter into her dress. And Stanley did many portraits where he is the male person, is smelling, soaking in, taking in these letters. And I find it very evocative of deep love. So those are three paintings that you saw of Spencer, just to give you an idea. We're going to talk a little bit about wilderness now. This is on Martin's Ridge, looking down at Golden Lake and Heart Lake. And I want to ask you, are you having the right kind of Holden experience? Okay? That was a great hike. Okay, but I'm halfway serious about the right kind of experience. For instance, you know, did Andrew have the right kind of boundary water encounter? Did Maury have the right kind of experience when he was searching the way up to the pass beyond Holden Lake? How many have know of or have been to Holden or to Zay? You know, it's an ecumenical place of prayer and pilgrimage in France. And often the question is, you know, are you having the right kind of experience? Or when you go to a monastery or convent, are you having the right kind of experience? And that's the kind of question that can tyrannize our real experience. What the real experience for Maury was that he didn't get up to the pass. And my real experience of Holden is that I was working too hard at the beginning, but those are the experiences that are granted us. And those are the experiences that become, if not the right experience, become the true experience, the real experience for us. Those of you who came in just a few moments ago, we're going to go through these slides and then we're going to listen to them to music in a moment. And this is in southern Israel, in the Negev, and it was a very rainy winter and spring. And so this is just a field awash in wildflowers in a place called Tel Arad, which is an early Canaanite archaeological site and an Israelite site. And I told you when we saw the John Dunn picture, entering paradise and these wandering figures. When we came up to Tel Arad, there are these figures. This is a metal. There are no flowers here. And people seem to be, these are Jews. I assume that they're not Orthodox Jews because they couldn't have gotten there on a Shabbat. But they're walking, and it almost seems aimless. I watched that. There's no sort of specific path that they're walking. They're just walking. And now we're not so far, we're still in the Negev, now we're going east and we're looking down on the Dead Sea. And this is one of the few routes coming up from the Dead Sea that the Romans used and earlier people coming over so that you could get to Gaza, which would lead you to the spice trade, which would lead you by boat to Ethiopia, to Egypt. And this is an ancient route, the only route that's really walkable except further north of the Dead Sea. And what's really amazing is this is the Syrian Rift Valley here, that the earth is split. And then in this next picture, we go to Kenya. This is the same valley that we were just looking at the Dead Sea in Kenya.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, we saw that in Tanzania.
Yeah.
So I didn't realize it. This goes back to the picture before by the Dead Sea again, sort of rough, inhospitable. Let me just turn this off. This is much more fun, though. At least for me, than talking about apophatic and cataphatic theology. We'll talk a little bit about how do you, when you're in the wilderness, you know, where, when you come up to the impossibility of saying anything meaningful about God. You know, what are there images that are available to you? There's certainly some wit said that when you come up against the impossibility of saying anything meaningful about God, what do? Well, you just write more extravagantly about God. And this isn't very far from where we live. We live in Jerusalem on the Mount of Olives, or lived in Jerusalem on the Mount of Olives, and we were right on the rainfall line, the watershed line. Everything to the east was dry for the most part, except this would have been, there would have been a kind of green fuzz this spring, and I couldn't quite photograph it. It's not here in this photograph. But there was a kind of green downy covering to these barren mountains in the spring. It was really beautiful. But this is an ancient hill that is crisscrossed by the wanderings of goats and sheep for, I assume, millennia. And water. And I do want to read one thing. I think how many of you use the With One Voice? And do you use the Leader's Guide? Find that. There's a wonderful Lenten liturgy. Holy God, our living water and our merciful guide, together with rivers and seas, wells and springs, we bless and magnify you. You led your people Israel through the desert and provided them with water from the rock. We praise you for Christ, our rock and our water, who joined us in our desert, pouring out his life for the world. And then I said, those of you who came in late, I said I wasn't going to talk at all or think at all in terms of this session about the current realities in the Middle East, in the Holy Land, in Israel, Palestine. But as I was just putting together pictures, I realized wildernesses are in lots of places. More I talked about the wilderness of the city, and this is certainly a wilderness. This is in Jenin in the northern West Bank, 2 weeks after an Israeli attack in spring 2002. And, you know, the desert or the wilderness can be in hospitals, in our inner cities, in so many places. That I felt like I needed to include these. Barbed wire and bags of sand used to keep some people in. And this is just a word of explanation. This is this wall of separation. Not in all parts is it concrete 24-foot high wall. In this case, it's about a 40-meter swath. Three fences. At least one is electrified, and between these two fences, it's raked, and there's a ditch filled with barbed wire, and then a security vehicle drives up and down. And this picture, the green line is to the west. In other words, this isn't built in the West Bank, over beautiful land. Now I want to show you Spencer's pictures, and that began in 1939 at that church in Cookham that I showed you at the beginning. In the back part of the church, Spencer noticed that there were these panels that were, I think, about 20 inches square, and he noticed that there were 40, and he began to think about all the images we have for 40 biblical images, 40 years, 40 days, and so on. And he wanted to do a kind of Lenten pilgrimage of Christ in the wilderness. And he only completed 8. And I would like to visit the archives at the Tate Museum sometime to find out if he talks about how he would have done the others. Because in the 8 that we have, there are no images of Satan tempting him. In fact, a number of the images really are outside of the the very minimalist story we have about Jesus in the wilderness, driven by the Spirit in the wilderness. And let me just read you some of the texts for these. And he didn't assign any text, so this is just what I've thought about and some of the obvious connections and some that aren't so obvious that may have been working. This is from Matthew 14. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up the mountain to him by himself to pray.
Can you speak a little louder, please?
Okay. When evening came, he was there alone. Mark 6. After saying farewell to them, he went up on the mountain to pray. Luke 6. Now during those days, he went out to the mountain to pray, and he spent the night in prayer to God. And John 6, when Jesus realized that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, he withdrew again to the mountain by himself. And this is one of my favorites, and an obvious referent here is, of course, consider the lilies. Matthew 6, and why do you worry about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. But also consider, and here I think this, I don't think Spencer was thinking of the Song of Songs, but I'm sure he was aware of it. And so I don't think it was in his intentionality or consciousness, but I heard these words. My beloved, this is from Song of Songs, chapter 6, verse 2. My beloved has gone down to his garden, to the beds of spices, to pasture his flocks in the gardens, and to gather lilies. And this, I think, is one of the most beautiful, and I think of Georgia O'Keeffe very strongly. Rising from sleep in the morning. Mark 1. In the morning, while it was still very dark, he got up and went out to a deserted place, and there he prayed. And there I also started to see a kind of yoga. It's very much like a yoga posture.
Michael, when you said rising from sleep in the morning, is that the title?
That's Spencer's title.
And Spencer also included the scripture passages?
No, he isn't.
Interesting things that he asked was, as he started this whole thing, was the question of, when I began to think about Christ in the wilderness, I thought, what did he do? Mm-hmm. You know, how did he occupy himself? What did he do in the wilderness?
I'll read a little passage from a little video or play about that.
Lizards?
The scorpions.
It's a scorpion. I'll read you that, and then I'll say a word or two. Scorpion, that's the title, from Luke 10. See, I have given you authority to tread on snakes and scorpions and over all the power of the enemy, and nothing will hurt you. Okay, fine, that's probably the obvious conscious reference, but then listen to this passage from Deuteronomy 8. Who led you through the great and terrible wilderness and arid wasteland with poisonous snakes and scorpions? He made water flow for you from flint rock. And Luke 11. And if the child asks for an egg, will you give a scorpion? And let me just mention that I have this marvelous video that's on the Europe. It's formatted for European TV, and I'll have to reformat it. But I would have liked to have shown it with the wonderful British actor Ben Kingsley, and it's only 10, 15 minutes. And it deals with this period in Spencer's life, his period in the wilderness in London, an area called Swiss Cottage, which was filled with refugees, many, many Jewish refugees from Eastern Europe. And I've talked with art curator, and we're both convinced that he's using real people for these portraits. And I think probably people from Swiss Cottage. He was essentially homeless, He showed up after being evicted from his home in Cookham at the doors of the director of the Tate Museum, and the maid took him to be a vagrant, a homeless man. And in the Ben Kingsley video, Kingsley, I won't try to imitate it, but he forms against a kind of blank hallway. He forms these postures, and you can see the connection between the wilderness of Stanley Spencer in London in the late 30s and the wilderness of Christ in the wilderness. Let me see if I can find that little passage. This is from the video, but Stanley Spencer wrote far more than Van Gogh. In fact, we have far more about Spencer's thoughts about art and his paintings than from virtually any other artist in history. And those are mostly in archives. He intended to write a large biography, autobiography, and he also thought that he was really the arbiter of what his paintings meant. That's a typical notion of, I think, of 20th century artists, that they are the ones who have the lock, the key to their work. When I was reading the Gospels, I wondered, what did Christ do in the wilderness? There was nothing specific in the Bible as to his doings and happenings. These pictures seek to convey the feeling of Christ being in the midst of the wilderness like some old, disused, familiar object that one discerns as something remote from one's own life, but which really is a core to everything. I wanted to see him as part of nature. I wanted to see him as part of us. Again, that we are connected to the places we come from, and the places that we come from are connected to us. A kind of belonging.
This background is really a Judean wilderness kind of background.
Yeah, that is perhaps the most. And then, of course, here's the one that all of us recognize. The title is The Foxes Have Holes, and both Matthew and Luke have reference. Jesus said to him, they're identical, "Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." And one of the things that's probably helpful to note is that, I wish I could show you more paintings, but there's a kind of volumetric size. I mean, this figure takes a large part of the picture. Right. There are smaller, they're about 18 to 20 inches, they're square. A large part of the picture, almost as if the frame, the picture can't be contained by the image of Jesus in there. And this is unlike a lot of Northern European representations of Christ. You seldom see a Christ that is sort of roly-poly. You seldom see a Christ that has a hooked nose. And I find these just, I love looking at them. So, let's see. Where is this one? Actually, the one that I showed an earlier one, we'll see that again, where he's sort of clinging to a tree branch. I think I called that, I read from that, he departed into a mountain to pray, onto a mountain. And actually, I think that was driven by the Spirit into the wilderness. And I think this is, he departed into a mountain to pray. And this is perhaps the most ambivalent one. And this is one where I would like to use a Greek word, apatheia, or indifference. And I think that there's something about the wilderness that you need both attentiveness and the cultivation of indifference. So it almost looks as if Christ is indifferent to what is happening here. You see this kind of antelope being devoured by these eagles. And as if Christ is not not even interested. He's lying there. Perhaps he's wondering what to do. But I think there's a kind of apatheia here. I think there's a kind of indifference to what is happening in order that he might cultivate a kind of attentiveness to other matters. But let's see, what did he call this? He called this the eagles. And here you also have a greater ambivalency in scripture as well, because to eat an eagle is unclean. And yet we have these wonderful images from the Psalms. So hear this from Leviticus 11. These you shall regard as detestable among the birds. They shall not be eaten. They are an abomination. The eagle, the vulture, the osprey. But also note Jeremiah 48. For thus says the Lord, look, he shall swoop down like an eagle and spread his wings against Moab. And then from Exodus 19. You have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. And then the last one, a kind of charming one. And I was really tempted to use Dan Kalman's piece, The Chickens. Yeah, that piece that we tried to hear at Vespers or at the concert the other evening. And here, I think Spencer is thinking of Matthew 23 and Luke 13. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. How often have I desired to gather your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you are not willing. And here I think there's a kind of attentiveness. Let me just go back to this. I think there is a kind of attentiveness to what is happening here, at least a certain kind of meditational power. So what we're going to do now is we're going to hear some music. You should make yourself relax. But are there questions or comments that anyone has, or anything that anyone would like to share?
The background in this one, are those roosters back there?
No, that was a hen. No, there was no rooster.
All hens.
Look at the top
there.
Right above
Zip.
Yeah, got the
waddle.
The cotton. The waddle.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're right. Yes, there's one over there, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
Got the idea from the spaces in his church had room for 40.
Yeah.
So that the dimensions, whatever you said, yeah. 18 by 18 inches or something.
Yeah.
Was
and I saw the spaces myself. I read that in there's one book of his notes and writings out, and I read that. But other people, other people don't point to that. And then one other aspect that I should have mentioned, well, it's really not that necessary.
Might be interesting.
Well, and the picture that for me is the most challenging is probably the picture where the eagle is devouring the antelope, the baby, the young antelope. And there are some scholars who think that perhaps, because Spencer, I told you, read widely and deeply, that at this time he was aware of Indian religion, and there were images that were similar. And I haven't seen those images, so I don't know that for a fact.
The piece of music that Michael chose for this is by Tavener, and it's called
John Tavener, who's an English.
And it's a piece that is very haunting from something called the Eternity's Sunrise. And there will be a period of silence in the midst. It goes a little longer than, don't be concerned about that. Just be in the silence.
I'm sorry. We'll get there, folks. Thank you. This from Matthew chapter 11. As they went away, Jesus began to speak to the crowds about John. What did you go out into the wilderness to look at? A reed shaken by the wind? So thank you for coming. I just finished reading here a book that I like to read, a novel, as I go into the world to sleep. And so I was just reading John Updike's A Month of Sundays, about a wayward Episcopal priest who's sent to a place in the desert to get over his sexual addiction. And on Sundays he writes these imaginary sermons, even though he's not allowed a Bible. So he wrote one about the wilderness, the encounter in the wilderness, and where he is. I didn't realize it until I finished. I didn't see the connection. He's at a place called La Palma de la Mano de Dios. I don't know, I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that right, but in the palm of the hand of God. And in the hand of God. And I think that was wonderful as an example of what the wilderness is. And I realized, though, that where it is geographically, that's Death Valley. I thought that was just amazing. The final quote that I maybe should have read at the beginning, which really sort of sparked my whole interest in trying to look at icons and images, is from Yaroslav Pelikan's Imago Dei, the Byzantine Apology for Icons. The ancient priority of hearing and biblical thought had now been forced to yield to the priority of seeing as a consequence of the incarnation. As word, he was still there to be heard and obeyed, but as light, he was now there to be seen as well, and therefore to be visualized. And I thought that was wonderful. So thanks a lot. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.